and quoting this, right, and says, we're on the fifth line from the bottom now, right? Omar Rav Huna. So Rav Huna said as follows, says, Lo Yishonu, he says, what this Mishnah is talking about is Elo La'osan Ha'omdim Atzfas Habor. We're talking only about those people who are standing at the edge of the pit. In other words, they're not inside the pit, but they're up on top, at the edge of the pit, and they hear somebody down below, in the pit, or in the cistern, blowing, right? Right. Or somebody was inside the barrel. Don't ask me why he would go in there, but maybe he went in order to... who knows? Maybe he wanted to hide from the authorities. I have no idea why. Okay.
Why is he blowing the shofar?
But he wants to fulfill the mitzvah.
I think the authorities
Who knows? You know, Jews were persecuted for blowing shofar, for pronouncing, for reading Kriya Shema, for studying Torah, and so on. So maybe that's why he went in there. I don't know why he went into it. They don't explain that. But there he was, inside, okay? So therefore, Rav Huna says, for those people who are standing on the edge, this is where the show. This is where the Mishnah is saying when he says that, you know, if they heard the original sound, right, then in that case they were yotzei. But if they heard only an echo coming from the pit, then in that particular case they were not yotzei. Okay, avol osan ha'omdim babor. But as far as those who are actually inside the pit together with the guy who is blowing the shofar, yotzo, there's no question that they have fulfilled their mitzvah. Why? Because they're right there where the guy is blowing the shofar. So there's no question that they fulfill it that way. Okay, so therefore, coming back to your question about the cave, okay, if a person was standing outside the cave but he could not hear the shofar and said he only heard the echo coming from it, then we have to say that the din applies there equally. But those people who are in the cave, and God knows people would hide in the cave in order to protect themselves from the authorities, or at times, I mean, simply because this is where they made their home. It was so hot outside in the desert that in a cave they found it was cool enough, you know, to be able to live. And so if they were provided with water and other necessities, then, you know, they could survive over there. And this is why, for example, in the hills of Yehuda, you know, you have dozens and dozens of caves, including, for example, the famous caves that the Qumran community, you know, with the scrolls and so on, you know, they lived in there. Okay, Qumran, yeah. Tanya Nami Hochi, and likewise we have a Baraisa that gives the same point. It says, Hatokeya the Socha Bor, that if a person blows inside a bor, or the Socha Dus, or into the Dus, Yotza, then he has fulfilled his mitzvah, right? The Hotnan, and didn't we learn Lo Yotza, that he has not fulfilled the mitzvah? Elalav, Shmaminor, so rather we have to say from this we learn, what? Kedarafuna. As Rav Huna said just a moment ago in the first interpretation they gave, Shema Mino, that this is the correct interpretation. Namely, that if they are standing, they're bystanders, but they hear the original sound, then in that particular case they're Yotze, but if all that they hear is an echo, then in that particular case they're not Yotze with it. Okay. Now, Iko de Rame Lehu Mirmo. There are those, however, who raise a question concerning what we just learned. They say, Tanan, we have this Mishnah which says, Hatoche l'sol chabor, l'sol chadus, lo yotza, right? It says that if he blows inside, he's not yotza. The Hoa Tanya, but then didn't we learn in the Barais, what? Yotza, that he did fulfill his mitzvah? Some Rav Huna, therefore, Rav Huna came along and he said, Lekasha, no, it's not a difficulty. Because he says, Kan lo yisanom dinat spas habor, for those who are standing on the outside and they hear it coming from inside there. So if they heard the original sound, they were yotze, but if not, no, lo yotze. But kan lo yisanom dinabor, but for those who are standing actually in the pit itself or in the cistern, then there's no question that they're right next to the person who is blowing the shofar. They hear the original one, and therefore they are yotze with the fulfillment of the mitzvah of hearing the sound of the shofar. Okay, we are now ready for the next sheet, but you'll excuse me for one. Okay, we now continue. Omar Rabba, or according to the Rosh, we should say Omar Rabba. Take your pick. It's either Rabba or Rabba. They're both great authorities, okay? And now we are ready for the next page, for Chof Ches Omed Aleph. Okay? It says, Shama Miksas Tekiya Babor Miksas Tekiya Otsfas HaBor. Let's say that you heard part of the sound of the shofar in the pit, and part of the sound of the shofar outside of the pit. So the Gemara says, Yotza, you have fulfilled it. You have fulfilled your obligation. What if it is Miksas Tekiya? Miksas Tekiya, Kodem She'ela with Hashachar. I'm having trouble with my vision tonight.
Do you need this?
No, that's okay. Yeah. It's just a question, you know, how I concentrate over here. Yeah. All right. It's coming through the wrong part of my eyeglasses. All right. What if you heard part of the sounding of the shofar before the morning star rises? Well, miksas tekiya le'achar she'yelam et hashachar, and part of the shofar after the morning star rises, then in that case, lo yotza. You did not fulfill it. Obviously, you didn't fulfill it. Why? Because you did not hear the entire shofar during the day. Now, I have to explain what is Amud HaShachar. Okay? The morning star rises roughly somewhere around 72 minutes prior to sunrise. Okay? But we learn from the book of Nehemiah that when they built the Beis HaMikdash, that is the second Beis HaMikdash, then at that particular time, he assigned, you know, work details to everybody. Half of the people worked from the time of the Amud HaShachar until sunset, and the other half of the people worked, you know, during the night. That they did guard duty, or they did building, or whatever it was, you know, that was necessary.
Because of the Samaritans,
yes. Exactly, because the Samaritans were trying to destroy the work that was going on, and the Samaritans also denounced them to the Persian authorities, right, saying that the Jews were planning, you know, to rebel against Persia and so on. So, you know, Nehemiah was sent over there as the troubleshooter in order to enable the Jews, you know, to go on with the work, because he was a high court official at the court of Persia. And therefore, the king and queen appointed him to go back to Yerushalayim and to supervise the work and see that the Beis HaMikdash could be built. All right. So from this we learn that the Amud HaShachar is the beginning of day. Because obviously, if the day shift began then, right, so this is now day. So for all practical purposes, when the Amud HaShachar rises, this is the time when the day begins. This is why I have the problem, for example, when, you know, I determine at what particular point does a fast begin. You know, like on Shavuot Batamis, or let's say Asar Batavis, or whatever it may be, and so on, okay? Tzom Gedalia, which will be coming up not so far off, right? So in that particular case, I have to take a look at the astronomical chart for Springfield, which is my guide, okay? And then I have to figure out at least 72 minutes prior to that, because that is the beginning of Amud HaShachar, and I always allow a little bit of a leeway, about 2 or 3 minutes, whatever it may be. So yeah, I generally work on the basis of about 75 minutes prior, okay? Meaning that that's as late as you can eat without violating the fast, because once the Amud HaShachar is there, then technically you have to begin fasting already, even though it's pitch black outside at that time. 72 minutes before, it's still dark outside. It's not light. But as long as we have a biblical reference, you know, to the fact that this is considered the beginning of day, then we go on that basis. And of course, therefore, how soon can you begin to daven shacharis? The answer is with this, all right? But nevertheless, there are those who are more machmir to say that, well, you can't, you know, you're not fulfilling the mitzvah, putting on tefillin and so on, until you actually have sunrise, which, as I said, is already at least 72 minutes after that, okay? So it's one of these problems. But if you have what we call a shas hadchak, in other words, you have an emergency, you have to get out early, you're going to work or you're going on a trip, whatever it may be, then in that particular case, you go on the basis that beginning with Amud HaShachar, this is the beginning of day, so that you can, you know, begin to daven shachars at that particular point. All right. Now, we also know, you know, that in the Beis HaMikdash, they had Levim and Kahanim, you know, who would be on guard duty to watch for the moment when they would first see the morning star up in the sky. When they would see it, they would yell, according to the Gemara in Yuma, they would say the word Bar Kai, which means it is shining, because it's a very bright star, okay? And that meant, you know, that they could then begin the preparations for the korbanos and everything else that had to be done in the Beis HaMikdash, beginning at that particular point for that particular day. Because you could not sacrifice, let's say, a korban prior to the Amud HaShachar and have it count for the day, as we see in this case over here too, that blowing the shofar has to be when? Mishayale Amud HaShachar. Okay? Purim, we are expected to read the Megillah twice at night, right? And then we have to read it again in the morning. At what time in the morning can we begin reading it? The answer is after Amud HaShachar. Read a Megillah before Amud HaShachar, and you're only reading it for the night. You're not reading it for the day.
Amud means?
Amud literally means column.
Column.
So means column. Sometimes over here we speak about, you know, dot so-and-so.
Yeah.
Right?
Page.
Right, page so-and-so. Amud, this and this. So you have Amud Aleph and Amud Beis. Literally it meant column one and column two. Right. Okay, so we are now on Chof Ches Omed Aleph, and we see then that if you blew the shofar partly before Amud HaShachar and partly after, you're not Yotze, because you have not blown it in its proper time, which is after the Amud HaShachar rises. Omele Abaye, Abaye said, Maishto Hosen de Beine Kula Tekiya Bechiyuva Veleka. Hochaname Beine Kula Tekiya Bechiyuva Veleka. So, he asks the following question. He says, why do you make a differentiation? You say that in one particular case, all right, top of the page, what does it say? That if he heard part of the tekiah in the pit and part of it at the edge of the pit, right, is yotze. Whereas in the second statement, he say that if he heard it before Amud HaShachar, he's not yotze, right? And even if he heard part of it after Amud HaShachar, he hasn't, because he has not fulfilled the whole thing, right? Says Maishno Hosam. What is the difference between that case, Dibeina Kula Tekiya Bechiyuva, where we require the sounding of the shofar to fulfill the obligation in its entirety, Veleka, and it's not so, right? It's not so. So Hochanami Beino Kula Tekiya Bechiyuva Veleka. So here too, in other words, he's saying, why do you say in case number one, right? On line one and a half, right? On line one and 2A, we say that if you heard part here and part there, it's okay, you yaitse. Whereas if you hear it prior to this, and even if you heard part of it afterwards, you're not yaitse, because you haven't heard the entire tekiah in its proper time. What's the difference? In both cases, he says, you haven't really fulfilled the mitzvah because you've only heard part here and part there. So he says, Hochi Hashta. Hey, he says, can you really now make a valid comparison between the two cases? Hotsam, let's take our latter case, right? He says, Laila Lavzman Chiyulahu. Klav. Right? In the case of the fact that, you know, he heard part of it, or he blew part of it prior to the rising of the morning star, right? It's still night. And that's not the time when we have the obligation to blow shofar. Shofar has to be blown during the day. Is there any scriptural reference to the answer? Yeah, of course. Because what do we refer to Rosh Hashanah?
Yom.
We call it Yom Teruah, exactly. Right? It is the day of the blowing of the shofar.
Right.
Yom Teruah. So if it is day, it has to be during the day. It can't be at night. We don't blow shofar at night, okay? So it's not at all the time when we are obligated to do it. But hachot. But here in the case of the bor, it says Mokam Chayunuhu La'osan Ha'omdim Abor. As far as the pit is concerned, it is a place where it is a place of obligation for those who are actually in the pit. Aye, somebody hears it in the pit and then goes out and he hears it again outside. But at least part of it, what? L'meimra, is this the Pelisah and the Sova Rabba, that Rabba said, that Rabba was of the opinion. Shoma Sof Tekiya below Tekhila. If you heard the sound of the Tekiya without hearing actually the beginning, right? Without hearing the Tekiya, the Tekhila's Tekiya, the beginning part of the sound, Yotzot, nevertheless, you have fulfilled your obligation. Umimela, and certainly all the more so, Tekhila's Tekiya, if you heard the sound of the beginning of the Tekiya sound, below Sof Tekiya, even though if you didn't hear the rest of it, Yotza, then you have fulfilled it. Just as, for example, you hear part of it in the pit, right? And then afterwards you hear part of it when you're outside the pit, but you heard part of it. So we said that you're Yotza. So he says, Toshma, look, let's analyze this. He says a little bit better. He says, let's hear. Tom means hear, and Shma means listen to me, okay? That's Toshma, okay? He says, talk up or we learned that if the guy blew, right, a tekiya sound, okay, we already had this mentioned before, and we saw that they were talking, we're not talking about where he blows tekiya and then followed by shvorim or trua, right? But the next tekiya, the one that completes the set, because we always have to have tekiya, shvorim or trua, right, or shvorim trua, and then tekiya, okay. And if you don't hear that tekiya afterwards, then it's not valid. All right, so let's say, okay, he blows a tekiya, right? Umashach lashnia. And then he just drags it on that second tekiya, kishtayim, as if it were the length, actually, of two tekiyas. Remember? So he says, ein biyodei elachas. We give him credit for only one tekiya, not for two tekiyas. Va'amai, why? The salik lo betarte, why can't you count it, let's say, as being two different tekiyas? So they answered, besuke tekiya, so mehadodei lepatskinim. It says you cannot break up one tekiya into two parts, one from another. So therefore, what? So therefore we have to say that you know, if we hear part of the tekiya, at least we have heard something. But it's no good if we simply make it twice as long and think that we're getting credit for two tekiyas instead of one tekiya. In other words, if we get credit for the tekiya at the end of the first set and the tekiya at the beginning of the second set. That won't work. Yes? It was mentioned before, I said. They go back and forth. Yes, they already quoted it previously. Yes. You're hearing the same thing, right? So what they said is that if you hear Niktzas, right, if you hear part of it, then you're Yosef, whether it's the beginning part or the ending part that you heard. Right, that counts as one unified one. But you can't take it and break it up into two. That's what they're saying over here. Okay. Toshma, we'll go a couple of more moments and then we'll call it a night. Toshma. Hatokei l'socha bor l'socha dus. He knows how to go back and forth over here. If you blow into the pit, right? Within the pit, or the tocha dus, inside the dus, or the tocha pitas, right? Im kol shofar shoma, right? If you hear the sound, the real sound of the shofar, then you yotze. Im kol habor shoma, but if you hear only the sound of the echo, it's lo yotze. So, va amai? So another Gemara asks the same question, why? Lipok betchilas tekiyo, become yotze kolo, why can't we be yotze by hearing the original sound before the sound got mixed up with what? With the echo. So he says, Ki ko omar Rabba, when Rabba made this statement, he says, Bitokeya the oila the nafshe. We're talking about a guy who is blowing, and while he's blowing the shofar, he's getting up from the pit and climbing up outside of it. So, if that's the case, so what if you would say as follows, Bahu the Sema, what if we should argue that Zimnin, the Mapik Reshe, that sometimes he simply sticks his head out, right? Ba'akate Shofar Babor, but while his head is out, the shofar, let's say, is pointed down inside the pit, the Korba Harmev Kola, and therefore we're getting a crazy sound because it's not the pure sound coming out of it. So Kamash Malon, therefore we learn, hey, let's not go to extremes. Such a Maisa, he says, doesn't normally happen. I mean, that the guy is going to come out of the pit with the shofar pointed down and his head out. So, okay. Normally if he comes out with the shofar, it's going to be in his mouth. Okay. All right, I think we'll stop at this particular point. And then, right, tonight is the 6th of September, 2000. Okay. And we are currently in the middle of Chof Ches, Omid Aleph, right? Halfway down, okay? And continuing Chof Ches. Chof Ches. Okay? Right. Yeah, Aleph, okay? And we are roughly a little just before halfway down. Okay?
Halfway down?
Yes. Near. Continuing from where we heard, from where we stopped the last few lines over there. All right. All right. I start now where it says, Omar Rav Yehuda. Okay? You see that? Okay. All right. Omar Rav Yehuda. If you see there's like a little marginal note in the text over there on the side. And if you go up a couple of lines from there, you can see Omar Rav Yehuda. You see the name Yehuda over there?
Yehuda.
Yeah, okay, that's where we are. All right, he asked the following question. It says, V'shofar shel ola lo yitka, v'yim toka yotza. Okay, going now into a complication. So let me explain, first of all, what exactly is at stake. All right. Remember the past couple of weeks, we've been learning about what disqualifies a shofar. So we were talking, you know, about the disqualification, which is based upon its physical appearance. In other words, it has a hole in it, or it has a slit in it, right? Or it's covered with gold, and the sound of it is distorted because of that. So we said, in all of those cases, we learned that you're not yotze with it, okay? You don't fulfill the obligation because there's something wrong with the shofar itself, and so you can't fulfill the obligation. Now, here they are talking about a different disqualification. They're talking about the fact that we have two different types of sacrifices. Okay? One of them, actually there are many kinds of sacrifices, but let me simply make a distinction between one and another that I mentioned over here. One of them is Ola and the other one is Shlamim. Now we know about the Ola. The Ola is an animal that has to be burned completely as a sacrifice, okay? But when I say completely, the truth of the matter is that sometimes something is removed from it and does not have to be sacrificed on the altar. Specifically, Torah mentions that the hide of the animal was given to the priest, to the Kohen, so that, you know, he could have it and he could use it for whatever purpose he wants or sell it, whatever it is. So provide a little bit of income for the Kohen, okay? Question is, let's say it's a horned animal, right?
What?
A horned animal. Let's say that they're sacrificing a ram, okay, as an ola, okay? Isle, you know, we always talk Isle Echad and so on, right? Okay. So, if they take a ram and they sacrifice it, what about the horn of it? Could it be used as a shofar? This is the question that they're asking, okay? All right. So, he starts by asking the following question. Of course, I mean, it's a theoretical question, but, you know, it's interesting all the different objections that are raised. You know, because they could think of all kinds of things that's wrong, okay? So he says, all right, what would happen, he says, if you take a shofar, you know, of an isle, a shofar shal ola, right? And he says, the shofar shal ola lo yizkan, you should not blow upon a shofar taken from a ransom that belonged to an animal that was to be burnt on the altar, okay? Completely. Why not? So the answer is because we have a principle of what we call me'ilah. Torah speaks about, you know, mo'al, if you did, you know, what is me'ilah? Me'ilah is if you make use of something which is supposed to be dedicated to a sacred purpose and you make use of it for your own private business, then in that particular case, you have taken away the sanctity of that particular object. You understand? So that's me'ilah, and the Torah prescribes, you know, a penalty for having done that. But the basic idea is that if you, the verb is mo'al, if you actually made this, you profaned this holy object, okay, if you did so, then two things happen. Number one is that it's yotze l'chulin, which means that it now becomes, as a result of you having violated, it's no longer sacred. It's simply, it's now ordinary, it's profane, if you wish, okay? Because, you know, we usually say, you know, sacred and profane, right? You know, kodesh and chol. So it now has become chol, it's become chulin, as we say, okay? And on the other hand, of course, you are expecting, you know, to pay an indemnity to the Beis HaMikdash or to the Kohen or whatever it may be, you know, for having done, you know, what you did for your action. Okay? All right. So, what Rabbi Huda is saying is over here that if you are to take a shofar of this type of a, you know, a burnt offering animal, you're not allowed to blow on it, right? The Yim Toka. But what would happen if you actually took it anyway and you blew upon it? Well, he says, Yotza, then in that case you have fulfilled the obligation of blowing shofar. Even so even though you should not have done it in the first place, right? But if you did it, then you yotze. Why? Because as I said a couple of moments ago, what you've done is that you've taken it out of its state of holiness and you've made it profane by taking it and using it in order to blow shofar. Okay?
But yes. Even though it's profane, you have done the mitzvah of blowing shofar.
Of course, you fulfilled the mitzvah of blowing shofar. Right.
Okay.
As we would say in French, far fallen, but okay. So it happened. Yeah?
After blood sprinkling, you can use
the horse. After blood sprinkling? Then definitely you should not be done. Okay. All right. Okay. We'll come to it, okay? We'll come to it. Yeah. All right.
In order
yeah.
to blow it,
yeah.
they would have had to willfully take it and do the cleaning out and the whole thing. It isn't
okay.
like they just took it and blew it. Right?
Essentially, you are right. But the question is, maybe for some reason or other, there was a break over there and it fell off the animal. Before it was born, or something like that, you understand? Or he removed it before the time that the blood was sprinkled on the altar, which would be the final act of kapuras, we would say, okay? So, whatever it is, but at any rate, he had it and so on. He should not have done it, there's no question about it, we didn't say. But if he did it, So the question is, has he fulfilled the obligation of blowing shofar or not? In other words, was this a valid shofar for that purpose? That's the question.
Now,
okay?
We say, who did it? Now, who would have done this?
Whoever blew the shofar.
Who would have taken the horn? The sacrifice is being done by the kohen.
Right.
So,
who's blowing it?
Who would have gotten the horn? How would anyone?
The chances
else?
Are, well, you know. Okay, let me explain.
You have a little kid thinking you're taking something away.
No. I just
whatever.
Okay. If it was within the
circumstances are not that clear over here. However, I do have to make one point clear. That even though the Kohen is the one who officiates at the sacrifice, the lay person who brings the animal that he wants to give as a sacrifice also has his or her share. There is what we call smicha. This doesn't mean rabbinic ordination for the person, but it means that you have to put your hands on the head of the animal, okay, and press down on it, and say that this is, you know, this is an oilo, this is a shlomim, whatever it may be, and so on. This is smicha, okay?
But the inhibition doesn't bring
it out. He could. Torah speaks in the very first chapter in Vayikra about voluntary olos. I mean, people feel that, you know, they want to sacrifice something very, very special. So that is an ola, okay? Because you have... You see, a chatos, which is a sin offering, that has to be for a specific reason that you're bringing it. That you're bringing it because you've committed a sin unwittingly, and then you will discover as time goes on that you did the wrong thing and you want to atone for it. That's why it's a chatos, okay? But in the case of the ola, you could be giving it simply because you feel that I want to dedicate that which I think is the finest kind of an offering that I can give to the Beit Shalalim, and so I want it to be an ola. And even a goy could dedicate also an ola. Yeah, Kohen gets nothing, exactly. Gets the hide, but he doesn't get anything else.
Like the Kohen gives nothing.
This is why our sages said in reference, you know, we have the beginning of Parshat Tzav. Okay, it's written. The Torah begins. Says, "Sav is Aaron, Yisbonov leMoses Toras Oyla." Okay, command. It says, "Aaron and his sons. This is the law as far as the Ola, the first offering, is concerned." All right, and the question is, why do they use such a strong word, Sav? In all the other cases, you know, it's not Aaron and Israel, and not Aaron Aaron, and so on and so forth. You understand? But here it says, command. So they say, because the Kahanim, they're not happy about the fact that they're losing out the portion of beef or whatever it may be. So you have to tell them that they have to exert themselves in order to make sure that they do it wholeheartedly. Okay. All right. Let's continue now with the next line. Okay. So, yeah, okay. We are right now over there again, continuing with what Rav Yehuda had to say. Okay. So he says that in the shofar, if you use the shofar of an ola, he says you should not blow yitka, right? You shouldn't blow. But v'yim toka, but if you did, you fulfilled it. Okay. How about the shofar shal shlomim? Shlomim are peace offerings. Okay. He says lo yitka, you should not blow with the horn of an animal which is for shlomim. V'yim toka lo yotza. And if he blew upon it, guess what? He was not. He did not fulfill this. Okay. So the question is, why the difference between the Ola and the Shlomim? So for that, we have to take a look at the Rashi, which is at the side, a little bit just above over there. Okay. Says, according to Rashi, okay, well, it's a long one over there, okay. Okay. He says that shel ola, all right, it says, v'tolshu mechayim, first of all, he says, they took it off from the animal while the animal was still alive, right? The evil of the achad zrika, because if they took it after the blood had been spilled upon it, ein me'ilo, then the law of me'ilo, in other words, that does not apply, in other words, you're not able to make it profane, lo be'ora v'lo be'kaneha, either with the hide of the animal or with its horns. In other words, he can't do it once the blood has been sprinkled. Okay? Why? Sha'akol ha-kohanim, because all that belongs to the kohanim. In other words, not just the hide, but also the horns belong to the kohanim. Okay? Kedaminim b'zubinochus b'zvachim, and so on. He brings the sources in other Gemaras where we have this law laid down. Nehemar lo yiyeh, it says, you know, concerning the offering, that it belongs unto him. Who is unto him? The answer is unto the Kohen. The Olam, right. The Nehemar lo yiyeh ba'oshem. The same thing it says also when it comes to the Oshem. The Oshem is what we call the trespass offering. That also is for certain specified things that we have in the Torah, that you have to bring that in order to atone for a violation. As for example, somebody entrusted you with a pikadon. In other words, he said to you, please do me a favor, keep an eye on this particular object while I'm away, and then, you know, when I come back, you'll return it to me, all right? So the guy said, okay. Man comes back and he says, I want to have you know that which I left with you. And he says, you never left me anything. Obviously, he took it for himself, right? He wanted it for himself. So, what happens, you know, when it is discovered, you know, that he was a god of this guy? So in that case, he has to bring an usher. He has to bring a trespass offering, okay? Besides making good, you know, to the person whom he wronged, but he also has to bring a trespass offering in order to atone for that specific sin. You understand?
One-fifth or what?
Well, he has to add a fifth, right? Add a fifth of the value, okay?
20%.
Huh?
20%. No, that's
20%
more.
20%, right. The fifth is 20% more, right.
That's only for Mekka.
Yeah, no, I'm not talking about Me'ila. I'm talking about Oshem. Okay. Yeah, Oshem too. I mean, you have to bring, you know, you have Asham Mitzorah, Asham, okay, and so on. So this is Asham Gizela. This is what we call Asham Gizela. It's a trespass offering for being a gazel, okay? You're a gazel. You're a thief, okay? So you have to make up for it. Okay. All right. Now, so it says, Ma Oshem Atzboisel Mutorn, Af Elo Atzboisel Mutorn. So he winds up by saying that just as the Oshem, the bones are permitted, so likewise the Olo also its bones are permitted. Naturally permitted to whom? Permitted to the Kahanim to make use of if they have particular need for it. Okay. But then we said a moment later that if he blew upon a shofar made from shlomim, from peace offerings, then in that case, not only he shouldn't, lo yiska, right, but v'im toka lo yosef, right? If he did, he was not fulfilling the obligation. So Rashi explains why not. That's the next line. He says, labenei me'ilonit. He says, shlomim are not subject to the law of trespass. Not trespass, but making profane, right? Me'ilon. So if it is not, then it means what? The ain meila bekodshim kalim, because that law does not apply to what we call the lighter kind of sacrifices. Okay, it only applies. He says elo be'emurim. It applies only to those parts of the animal which have to be burned on the altar. Okay, ula'achan zvika, right? And it's also after the blood has been sprinkled on the altar, and it's made clear as to which part of the animal is going to be offered on the altar as a sacrifice, right? And the rest. So, that being the case, what do we see? We see that trespass, I don't want to use, I'm mixing up the terms, because it's going to be confusing.
This we call profaning. Misappropriation.
Okay, very good. Misappropriation, all right? Me'ila, yeah.
Embezzlement.
But I mean, it's not exactly embezzlement either. I mean, when you take something, unless you're saying, I mean, that you're embezzling from the Rebbeinu Shalom. Okay, or from the coin, or whatever it may be. All right, call it that. All right, so let's say embezzlement, right? Does not apply to kodshim kalim, because it would only apply to certain parts of that animal, namely that which has to be offered on the altar. Okay? But it would not apply to any other part. Well, if that's the case, it means that they're not making profane the horn of the animal that you want to use as a shofar. It still is in a state of what? It's still in a state of sanctity. It belongs as part of the animal. So therefore, you can't do it. This is the what Rav Yehuda is saying, okay? That's complicated. I'm not saying it's easy. But, you know, in order to understand what he's trying to say over here, so we have to understand, you know, the background of what he's saying.
Is that sacrifice on a peace offering is on a higher order than the Ola?
No. On the contrary.
On the contrary.
You have, okay, first of all, there are three that are called Kodesh Kadoshim, Holy of Holies, okay? One is the Ola, the burnt offering. Another one is the Chatos, the sin offering. And then the third one is the Osham, the trespass offering. And as I said, the Chatos and the Osham come for specific reasons, okay? Whereas the Ola could be anything that you, and your own generosity, you feel that you want to give a burnt offering as a sacrifice, okay? Then you have the category of what we call Kodshim Kalim, which means these are sacrifices that you make, but they're not of the same sanctity. It's a lighter type of a sanctity. Now, what are they? So they would include certain things, as for example, first of all, shlomim, which means peace offerings, todah, which means the thanksgiving offering, okay? And then we have some other things, as for example, maaser, which means maaser behemoth, in other words, you know, every tenth animal. Okay, so that has to be given. And you also have, for example, Bechor, the firstborn animal, but that belongs to the Kohen. That does not belong to you. But the others, they belong to you. Okay? And of course, the Kohen Pesach is another example of Kodshim Kalim. Okay? With them, those. Right. Beginning of the Siddur, you find. Yeah, right. These are things where the person who brings the sacrifice enjoys most of the animal, okay? He, his family, and so on and so forth, okay? And in addition, one portion is burnt on the altar. This is what he referred to, what Rashi referred to as chelik gavoa, in other words, the portion which is given to the Beit Shalalim. And then there is another portion which is given to the Kohanim, okay? Because we read in the Torah just the other week, right, that what does the Kohen get? He gets Hazroa, which means he gets, you know, the shoulder, okay? The Hal Chayim, he gets the cheeks of the animal, right? The Hakeva, in other words, the maw of the animal. And those are the things that the Kohen is entitled to, okay? So they have to be given to the Kohen. But the point is, everybody else, you know, can enjoy the rest of the animal, okay?
Right.
Yes. All right. All right. So, and the Gemara explains, my Tama, what is the reason for this differentiation between the Ola, right, and the Shlomim, that is the horn, you know, a shofar taken one? As it says, Ola, he says, must be Elohi. The Ola, if you were to take it, it would be subject to this law, as David says, embezzle. The Im Toka Lo Yotza, right? And if he, the Yim Toka, Yim Toka Yotza. And if he blew upon it, well, it's already been profaned, so therefore he would be Yotza with it. But the Shofar Shal Shlomim Lo Yiskar, with that of the Shlomim he cannot blow, the Yim Toka Lo Yotza, my Tama, what reason? He says, Ola Bas Behilohi, whatever, saying the same thing over again. Yeah. All right, Ola is subject to the law of embezzlement, right. Because the moment that he made a profane use of it, then automatically it is now profane, it is now chulin, and now it can be used for whatever purpose. Whereas shlomim, the lav b'nei me'ilon, they are not subject to this ruling, so isuruhu, they are prohibited, there is a prohibition, the rochim behu, which rests upon these animals, right? And in parenthesis, and you cannot make them into ordinary things. Alright, so this was Rav Yehuda's opinion. So, all of a sudden, there's an objection. You know, they argue back and forth, okay. I say we're good in, you know. Each one is entitled to a different point of view, right? So it says, Matzkev lo Rava. So Rava did not like this interpretation of Rav Yehuda, and Matzkev literally means he attacks it. So that, in other words, he challenges it. Okay, I think challenge is a nicer word, okay? He challenges it. He says, Amas Boal. He says, when exactly does Me'ila take place? It's the Vasa de Toka. If it first happens, it happens after he is already blown upon the shofar. Then he is now in violation. So if that's the case, if we say that the violation first occurs after he is blown upon it, so ki kotoka beyusura toka. If that's the case, it means that when he blew upon it, he blew upon it when it was prohibited for him to blow. So if that's the case, how can you say, as Rav Yehuda says, that you're yoytzer?
Yeah.
You say, no, you're not yoytzer with it. Elo Amar Rava, but rather Rava maintains the following, and he says, Echod Zeh, the Echod Zeh makes no difference whether it is with the shofar taken from an Olo, the shofar from Shlomim, Lo Yotza. Okay? Doesn't go. You're not yoytzer. You don't fulfill the commandment. The 13th of September in the year 2000. We are in the middle right now of Chof Ches Omud Aleph. Okay. Continuing to where we left off. Okay. So, other Omar, afterwards he said, Echod Zeh, V'Echod Zeh, Yotza. That it makes no difference whether it is, you know, there's no problem with me, you know, and so on and so forth. Even if you blew upon something that you would think it was lo yotz, I've changed my mind, he says, you're yotz with you blew it. Why? Because he says, mitzvos lav lehonos nitnu. This was the phrase that we were discussing last time. He says that the mitzvos were not given to us in order to derive any benefit or any enjoyment from it. So again, it all depends how we understand the word lav lehonos. We know that the word hanah normally means pleasure, but hanah also in the language of the Gemara means that you put it to some particular use for your own private purposes. Okay, so he says that the mitzvahs were not given for given to us in order to let's say to entertain us, to amuse us or something like that, but as Rashi stresses, the mitzvahs were given to us because the Rabbeinu Shel Olam gave its commandments, and he said that this is the oil mitzvahs, as we would say. In other words, this is the yoke of the commandments that is placed upon each and every one of us that we have to observe, and we should observe it because Rabbeinu Shel Olam said, observe my mitzvahs. Omer Rav Yehuda. So Rav Yehuda said, mitzvahs, right, okay, Omer Rav Yehuda. The shofar shall obey the Zorah lo yiska, right? He says that if the shofar came from an animal which had been dedicated to idol worship, you're not allowed to blow upon it. Why not? Because we have a general rule that the things that pertain to idolatry may not be used by us, okay? Not allowed to have hanor, in other words, we're not allowed to have private use of things that were consecrated to idolatry. Nevertheless, what does he say over here? He says, the yin toka, nevertheless, if he did blow on it, yotza. He still has fulfilled the commandment. Now, obviously, why? Because if he holds this period that the principle that mitzvahs lovely, you know, it's nitnu, right? They were not given for us for our private entertainment or something like that, or private use, then in that particular case, you blew, that's it. You blew because you wanted to fulfill the mitzvah of blowing shofar. Right? So that therefore you're yoytzer with that. The shofar shalir hanidachas, one of it is a shofar of the city which was condemned to be destroyed because the entire population had turned to idolatry. Lo yiska, not to blow with it. The yimtoka lo yotzer. And if he blew with that, here he was not yoytzer. My tama, what reason is it? Why is this different from the previous one? The other one said, you know, that if it was Aveda Zorah, Right? But if he blew upon it, he shouldn't, but if he did, so he was yoitzer. Here we say that if it's from the year Hanidachas, where the whole city turned to idolatry, you're not yoitzer. So he says, why, Talmud, what is the difference? So he says, because the two are not in the same category. Year Hanidachas, the city which, has turned, literally has been seduced to idolatry. There we have a law in the Torah that says that it is to be destroyed, right, completely, and that includes not only the city, its inhabitants, but also everything within the city, including all the possessions that they had over there. So in that case, let's say if there was a shofar over there, then in that particular case, kisusei michta shiure, then in that case, it's condemned to be burned, it's condemned to be destroyed, right? And therefore, you don't have a shear, you don't have a kosher or sofer, nor a support. So therefore, that's the difference. Omar Rava. So now we come to a different problem. Rava said as follows. Hamudar ha-no'a me-chaveiro, muto nesko'alo tekiyo shomitzvah. Okay. First of all, we have to understand what is this business of mudar. We have a big gemara called the Dorim, which means literally vows. Okay? Now, the vows that are spoken about in this particular Gemara are vows that people take, first of all, upon themselves, that they say, I take a vow not to eat this, or not to drink this, okay? All right, that we can understand. I mean, a person wants to go on a diet, but he wants to make sure he's going to enforce his diet, so he says, I make a vow that from this point on, I'm not going to eat anything that contains fat, sugar, okay. So this is in order to strengthen his resolve. Okay, so that's one type of a neder. Now, what happens afterwards? If you realize that you can't abide by it, so in that case, what are you expected to do? So you have to go to a chochem, somebody who knows the law, and explain the case to him. He'll ask you questions and so on. If he finds out, that you didn't really realize what was in store for you, so he has the ability to permit you, to dissolve the vow. Okay, that's one type of a neder. But then...
Neder means a vow. Neder is a vow.
Right, okay. Then we have a different type. And that is where one guy doesn't like another guy. Okay? So he says to him, I make a neder, he says, that I'm not going to go into your house, or I make a neder that I'm not going to eat any food that your wife cooks in the kitchen, or whatever it may be, okay? So the question is, in that particular case, he has to abide by it, right? He could also make the following neder. He says, I make a neder that you're not allowed to come into my house, or you're not allowed to have any enjoyment for me. People are mean. I hate to say it. They take these nedarim, they take these vows one against another and so on. Okay? So again, obviously, conditions are such that they can't abide by it, so you have to go to a chacham and find out whether there's any possibility to be released from the vow. Yes? Okay, that's a very, very good question that you asked. Okay. Right. We learned right in the very first chapter the importance that if a person makes a vow, he has to abide by it. Remember? So that if a person, for example, made a vow that he's going to bring a certain type of a sacrifice on the Beis HaMikdash, we had pages devoted to how long a time does he have before he's in violation of the commandment, the losa achad eshalma, that you should not delay in fulfilling your vow. Okay? We have pages of that. Now, if a person makes a neder, I hereby pledge, let's say, $25 to the shul. Okay? So, presumably what? He's going to fulfill his neder and pay them $25 to the shul, okay? But some people, unfortunately, are not sure that they'll ever be able to fulfill the vow that they make. So that, therefore, they say b'li neder, in other words, I undertake it, but b'li neder, I'm not committing myself by a vow that I'm going to fulfill it. Maybe I won't be able to, or something like that. So as Arthur said, I mean, this is an escape clause when you're doing
it. I'll see you tomorrow. You later. I don't know that I'll see you tomorrow. You may not be
able to
come.
This is necessarily giving him money. I mean, it could apply to many situations, okay? Yeah, b'li neder, exactly. I mean, as Arthur said, for example. Yes. Okay. Now, of course, that leads us to the discussion of what it's called nidre. Okay. All right. Kol Nidre is a prayer, right, in which we say all these nidoris that I made, various types. I mean, shvue, these are oaths already. Koname, you use the expression konam, which is a common expression for making a neder that's prohibited to me, and so on and so forth. So in all these various types, okay, we say that if we made them and we weren't able to fulfill them from last Yom Kippur to this Yom Kippur, right, they should be forgiven. Actually, the wording was changed, not from last, but it's made for the future. It's a b'li neder clause that you're saying that from Yom Kippur Mzeh Ad Yom Kippurim Habolim L'Tova till next Yom Kippur, which had come to us, you know, that if I made them and I didn't understand them, then icharat no behol. In other words, I have charota, I have regrets that I made this, and so on and so forth, right? And then they should all be shvikin, shvisa, in other words, pavim b'tom, they should be considered, you know, as null and void, exactly, okay? Well, of course, the idea is, in this particular case, we're talking about vows that you made to the Beit HaShalem. You said that you're going to, you made a vow that you're going to say Tilim every day, and you didn't, okay? Or that you were going to study a Blat Gemara every day, or that you would go to a Shiur every day, or something like that, and you weren't able to fulfill this. So therefore, you prayed to God, you know, please forgive me, I made a vow in all good faith, hoping to be able to fulfill these things, because I wanted to be a better person, a better Jew, but I wasn't able to do it, so God forgive me. And if I vow for the future, you know, to try to do these things and I'm unable to fulfill, so please God forgive me for this. It does not absolve a promise that you made to somebody else and you failed to fulfill. That's already in a different category. Right.
Now, how does this compare with the kind of, how is a vow compared to something like a resolution? Not quite the same.
Okay, no, you're right, but we have different categories. As for example, one of them is what we call a hanhoga toiva, which means that, you know, you do something that's good, a good custom, so to speak, and then you do it again and again and again. Well, if you do it three times, it's already become like a fixed thing, okay? So, if you know that you won't be able to fulfill it at all times, you should say, I'm making a condition now that even, you know, this hanhoga toiva that I make, you know, that I'll try to do it to the best of my ability, but if I can't fail, you know, if I cannot, I cannot, okay? It's a problem. I had a personal problem this year. In Eretz Yisrael, the minhag of Eretz Yisrael is that whether you're Ashkenaz or Sephardi, you say during the period of time between the beginning of Pesach until Shmini Atzeres, you say Morid Hatal in Atogibor. Okay. In the Galut, the Ashkenazi custom is not to say it. You won't find any mention of Morid Hatal in the average siddur that we have over here. Okay. I was in Eretz Yisrael when we started to say it, and I was there naturally from Eretz Yisrael. I davened according to the Nusuf of Eretz Yisrael, okay? So I said it again and again and again. Now, technically, I should be saying it every time I say Shemin Esrei at this point. But since there are times that I can't do it, let's say if I'm davening for the Yomid over here or something like that, but we don't say it. So therefore, I made a mental reservation in my mind. This is like the bidding letter, right? That I made a tanai or a mental reservation in my mind that where I can, I say it, and where I can't, I don't say it. And if I feel like it, and so on. It's based upon, I'll tell you a fact, something that we learned In the Gemara in Tainus, when we studied Tainus, okay? Tainus, in the first chapter, speaks about the importance of saying Masha Baruch Mo'ed HaGosh, okay? And it delineates, you know, the fact that when do we start saying it? So we saw that there was a difference of opinion among some of the authorities, but the prevailing opinion is that we start on Shemini Atzeres, and this is our custom to this very day, that we say Masha Baruch Mo'ed HaGosh, okay? Following that, there is a discussion about what if you wanted to say, let's say, to mention the winds, that's Masha for Ruach, or if you wanted to mention Tal, Tlolim, do. So it says that is optional, it's not required. Okay? So there are minhagim, including the minhag of Israel, where it's considered no longer optional, but it's considered, you know, is required. But for us, who follow the Ashkenazi custom in the Gola, so it's purely optional. You'll find a few people who say Moratol even now over here, okay? But it's only optional. We are not required to do it. So this is why I made the mental reservation that if I feel like saying it, I say it. If I don't feel like saying it, I don't say it. Yes?
I wonder if you could explain us the historical
All right. The answer is that, in reality, first of all, I have to say that Kol Nidre dates way, way back, centuries before there were such things as Marados in existence, okay? But, you know, it became a popular story that the Marados were very anxious to say Kol Nidre on Yom Kippur, because what they had in mind is that whatever pledges that they had made to the church authorities, that, you know, that they were now new Christians, right, and that they had become converted, that but in their heart of hearts, they wanted to remain Jews. And so therefore, whatever vows they had made in the church, they considered them, you know, betalim, right, that they considered them null and void as far as, you know, their own personal feelings and practices are concerned. Whatever they could get away with, secretly they did. So, you know, it became romanticized that Kol Nidre became associated with the Marados in Spain. But as I say, in reality, it goes right back to the time of the Gaonim. In other words, probably the 8th, 9th century, we already have it. And it's based upon a Gemara in the Dorm, which says that at the beginning of the year, actually, that says Rosh Hashanah. If you know that, you know, you won't be able to fulfill, then you say at the beginning of the year that anything that I haven't been able to fulfill, that it should be considered null and void and forgiven unto me, or something like that. So we moved it up from Rosh Hashanah to Yom Kippur, but still we have a ceremony before Rosh Hashanah that we call Hatoras Nedarim. Right. Pardon me? Yeah, I mean, we used to do it over here in the shul, usually before Yom Kippur. We changed it a few years ago, made it before Rosh Hashanah, the way most people do it, okay? Most people are in the habit of doing Hatoras Nedarim, where after the davening in the morning, you know, we sit around the table over here, and we divide half of the people, or the bezel, and the other half of the, and then we switch sides and so on.
Why isn't Yom Kippur right. Maser?
Huh?
Why isn't most of the Yom Kippur Maser?
You'll find it more in the Rosh Hashanah box. Take a look and you'll see. Take a look. Yeah.
Sacrifices?
Okay. The answer is yes, except that the Kol Nidre was formulated after, long after the sacrifices ceased. Okay? Long after. I said this goes back to about the 800s or something, 700, 800, you understand? That's when we first find it. We find it already in the Siddur of Rabbi Amnon Gon, for example. You'll find it, okay? But with sacrifices, we learned a long time ago, at the beginning of the Gemara of Rosh Hashanah, that you have a certain time period in order to fulfill your vow, but you must fulfill your vow. Otherwise, you are guilty of violating a commandment in the Torah, which says that lo tz'acher, right? L'shalmo, you should not delay in fulfilling fulfilling the vow that you did. Okay?
So if you make a vow,
yes,
then at Yom Kippur time,
yeah,
with the Kol Nidre, you are absolved. If you fail to follow through.
Yeah, right. But as I say, this is a vow that you've made because you want to strengthen your religious personality, your Jewish personality, whatever it may be. And, right. And then you can't fulfill it, so you pray to God to forgive that. Yes.
My grandfather, I witnessed when I was about 5 years old, I witnessed my grandfather in a ceremony with his oldest son, my uncle.
Yeah.
Our dining room, where she made him put on a talis,
yeah,
and made the vow, which wanted him to stop gambling. And now I only remember this as a from my childhood.
Right, right.
And he made a regular ceremony. I picture it in front of standing. What do they call the high boy thing.
The buffet, or whatever.
Standing in front of the sideboard and putting the talus, and he was wearing the talus with his usual, because he used to say his morning prayers there.
Right.
He did his car, his tefillin, that he always used to do it at home.
Yeah.
He had to go to business.
Yeah.
And I can remember that as clear as day.
Right.
I was between 4 and 5 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And I wondered, in later years, my uncle wasn't a gambler,
but he wanted to strengthen his resolve, and therefore he put
a
special.
Married man.
Okay, the last story that I just want to add in connection with this, okay? Another thing that we call, another way, is called a tekiyas kaf, which means a handshake, believe it or not.
Yeah.
I had Shalom, a brother-in-law, married to one sister, okay? Great Talmud Chacham. But, he spent all his years in working and in learning. He worked at all hours of the night, the day, and so on. Right? He was a hard worker. But it was a great Talmud Chacham. At any rate, he was also an inveterate smoker. Okay? So one time, Rav Bik, Olfa Shalom, a very famous Rav in New York, in Brooklyn, first it was in the Bronx, then in Brooklyn, he said, give me your hand. So Nechemi gave him his hand, and he said, I'm making the kiosk cough right now, that you must cut out smoking immediately. And he did.
And he did.
And he did. From that point on. Just like that.
That would be great.
Right, he believed, absolutely. Yes.
I just wondered, for my uncle's soul's sake, what happened.
What was the expression again?
That's called a tekiyas kaf.
Tekiyas.
Right. Tekiyas. We know tekiya is blowing a shofar, but this is tekiyas kaf, which means a handshake. Right, yeah.
Diamond trader, this used to be a contact with the handshake.
Never a written contact. Yeah, this is true.
Always a
handshake. This is sort of in the same category.
Today, I question.
Yeah.
How about putting a hand on the thigh? Wasn't that a...
That goes only in the Bible, you find that.
But that was the same kind of...
Yeah. Originally, as we say, this is the kitas kefas. They want, something sacred to hold on to as a pledge. Just as people, for example, swear on the Bible today. The same thing. All right, so let us continue now, okay? All right, so Gemara now says, Omar Rava, Rava said as follows. He says, Hamudor Hanoa Mechaveiro, a person says that I refuse to have any benefit from you. In other words, I don't want to get any kinds of a favor or anything at all. I don't want to do any business. I don't want any favors for you, all right? Nevertheless, if let's say that person is a Baal Tekiyah, he has a shofar and he blows it, so nevertheless that person is permitted to blow the shofar for him. So you ask the question, why is he permitted to blow it for him? After all, he's deriving benefit from the other guy's blowing shofar. So we say, because it's Tekiyah Shal Mitzvah. There's a mitzvah that's involved over here, and if it's a mitzvah, then that is not like the ordinary vow that you're not going to have any benefits from the other person. Okay. So this we understand. The mitzvah is involved over there. But Hamudar Hanor Mishofar. One of the guys says, I refuse to have any benefit from this particular shofar. You understand? It's not saying now from the other guy, but it says from this shofar. Then if that's the case, it says, Mutar Liskoa Bot Tekir Shal Mitzvah. So nevertheless, the shofar may be used to blow in order to fulfill the mitzvah for it. So in other words, in certain cases, even though you say that you are Mutar Hanor for me, but if there's a mitzvah that's involved, so in that particular case, the mitzvah overrides this business that you said, I refuse to have any benefit from you. Okay. The Yomar Rova, and Rova said along the same lines, Hamudar Hanor Mechaveiro, right? If a person, you know, again, takes this pledge and refuses to have any benefit from the other person, Mazer Lov Mechatos, so that person, if he's a Kohen, can sprinkle him with the water of the Poraduma. Let's explain again what this is. If you remember, we have at the beginning of Parsha Chukas in the Torah that the story about the red heifer, right, which is burnt, and then the ashes are mixed with Mayim Chaim, right, spring water, and also it has to be sprinkled with hyssop, you know, leaf, right, and Gurus Ezo, okay, so the what is the purpose? The purpose is in order to release him from the tumah, from the impurity, right? Particularly that which is incurred by contact with a dead person. Okay? Because later on in the same parak it says over there, Zos HaTorah Odom Kibbutz Be'ohel, the person dies and, you know, within an enclosed area, then called Be'ohel Hashem Be'ohel Yit Moshe Vashem, then person or whatever is in that particular area becomes unclean, a tumah, right? Become for 7 days. So, in order to affect it, so you have to sprinkle mechatos. All right. So he's saying, even though he is mudar hanoah from that particular person, nevertheless, if that person is a kohen, he's still permitted to sprinkle him with the this water which contains the, you know, the ashes of the parah adumah. But when it's bimos hakshomim, during the rainy season, on rainy days, he can do it. Avalo bimos hachama, but not on sunny days. So you say, why? He's still fulfilling a mitzvah. Yeah, but the point is, on a rainy day, if he's sprinkled with water, no, he's going to get wet anyway. So there's no particular hanor from the sprinkling with the water or the poraduma, right? But if it's a hot, dry day, sunny, and somebody sprinkles you with water on it, that particular case, you get pleasure out of it. You cool off a little bit. You feel refreshed. So in that particular case, then you're not yetzer. Okay. Then, along the same lines, okay, Hamudar Hanor bin Bayon, what if a person says that I'm not going to have any benefit from this particular spring water? Okay, it's the water. It's in the spring, and the Bayon, which, of course, actually, you have to realize, is big enough for what? It's big enough for immersing yourself, using it as a mikveh, okay? So, nevertheless, it says, Togel boy, Tevilo shel mitzvah, you are permitted, if you have to Togel, in other words, you have to immerse yourself for purposes of fulfilling your mitzvah, be most hakshomim, in the rainy days, because it's not going to make any difference again. If you go into over there, so the wetness itself that you experience is itself, you're wet anyway, okay. Avolo be most hachava, but not in the day, on sunny days, when going into the mikveh will give you pleasure. As long as you made a vow that you're not going to use this particular area, then you can't use it. That's all. Shochulei labuha de Shmuel. Question was raised. They sent the following question to Shmuel's father. Shmuel is, of course, a very, very famous Amora. We always talk about Rav and Shmuel, if you remember. You know, the two great contemporaries. Each of them founded their own yeshiva. And they're always differing about one thing or another, okay, but both are great authorities. So they sent the following question to Shmuel's father, who is also a great Talmud Chochem in his own right. And they said, kefoah the ochal matzah yotza. We have a teaching that says that if somebody compelled somebody to eat matzah, and of course we're talking about the first night of Pesach, yeah, right? And he ate this matzah, but he was doing it only under compulsion, right? Yotza. So the question is, is he yotza? Has he fulfilled the mitzvah that we have to eat matzah the night of Pesach? Yes, why shouldn't he? So the answer is, this goes back to a question that we had in the previous Mishnah, the one that served as a text. What did we say? We said over there that if a person is walking in the streets behind the shul, right? Or he lives in a house which is right next to the shul, and it's Rosh Hashanah, they blow shofar, okay? And he hears it. The question is, has he fulfilled his obligation for listening to the shofar or not? So we learned over there that in Kivein Libo, if he had kavana, in other words, he wanted to fulfill it, then in that case, yotza. V'im lav, but if not, he didn't. And the same thing with the reading of the Megillah on Purim, that if he lived next door to the shul where they were reading the Megillah and he could hear the reading of the Megillah from beginning to end, right, was he yotze? So again, the same thing they say, im kivein libo, if this is what he had in mind to do, so he wants it, you know, he has the kabbonah, as we say, for it, then in that case he has fulfilled his obligation. And if not, no. So we go back over here to the same problem. This person who ate the matzah, he didn't do it because he had the kavana to do it, right? But instead, he was forced to do it. So now the question is, has he thereby fulfilled the mitzvah anyway or not? And this goes back to a machlokes that we have in the Gemara Brachos, second chapter over there, that if a person is studying Torah, right, and he comes to the passage of the Shema Yisrael, okay, in his studies, so is a yotze with the obligation to recite the Shema Yisrael as part of either the morning or the evening, right? So the answer there that they gave again is the same thing. In kivein libo, if this is what his intention was, then it was yotze, and if he didn't, he didn't, right? And then the discussion followed to see whether in reality this is a basic principle or not. Whether, in other words, a person, even if he doesn't have kavana, but he fulfilled the mitzvah, then does it count as fulfillment or not? This is the basic problem that we have at this particular point, okay? So, if he ate under compulsion, do we say then that even though he had no intention of eating the matzah at that particular point, but nevertheless having eaten the sufficient quantity of matzah that he had to, so he was already yotze with that mitzvah or not? So he says, kefor iman, who compelled him? So he says, ilaymor kefor yishayid, if we say that what compelled him was a devil, a demon, in other words, mishigas, right? Then in that particular case, we have the following law. V'hot Tanya, did we learn that in connection with that type of a situation, itim chalim, if at times the person is perfectly sane. Chalim is related to the Hebrew word achlama, which means to be healthy, or today they use it for a convalescent, right? Okay.
Not
so,
connected with chalam, which is...
No. I mean, it's the same root letters, but it's a different meaning. Right, okay. So, if itim at times he is chalim, he is sane, and itim shota, but at other times he is insane. All right, shota literally means a fool, but here it means like insane. Okay, so kishahu chalim, if he performs an action when he is sane, harehu kafikeach lechol dover. Then in that particular case, it counts as if he is absolutely cognizant in whatever thing that he's doing. He knows what he's doing. Okay? And kishehu shoita, but at the time when he is insane, then harehu kishoita l'chodavar, in that case he's like an insane person in whatever his actions are. Okay? So getting back over here, the implication would be that if he knew what he was doing, right, then in that particular case it would be yotze, right? If he didn't know what he was doing, then in that particular case we would say he's not yotze. But why is it not yotze? On the contrary, because a shoyter actually has no obligations whatever. You go to an insane asylum and say put on talis and tefillin, I mean, it wouldn't mean anything, you understand? Eat kosher. So that, you know, in many cases, you know, it's an impossibility. So that that being the case, then in that case, we say that they are excused for mitzvahs at the time, you know, that they are afflicted with insanity.
So how do you know that at this moment he is not? Sean, I'm telling you, you're not.
Yeah, okay. That's already, that requires investigation, obviously. It requires investigation. Yeah, right, right. They have to evaluate. That's why we have psychological testing, right? And that's why a court will appoint somebody to give an expert opinion, things like that, exactly. Look, how many cases, you know, are brought before a judge today, brought into the court today that, you know, person pleads insanity or something like that, right? I mean, we know that.
Experience.
Yeah. So we have to have people, you know, who are expert enough. Right.
Yeah.
All right. So, at any rate, in this particular case, then this is not the question that they're asking. So Rav Ashi comes up with a different explanation as to who forced this person to eat. And he says, Shekfo'u Parsim, he says, the Persians forced him. Okay. Now, why the Persians? Of course, the answer is that the Gemara was written where? In Babylonia. But what was Babylonia? Babylonia was part of the Persian Empire. It was the Persians who ruled. So these anti-Semitic, these Persians, they grabbed hold of him and say, you eat matzah. And they stuffed him with matzah. And it was the first night of Pesach. Then in that particular case, is he yotze or not? You understand? This is what the question is. So, in other words, what is the conclusion? We would have to say yes. Even though he did not have the kavana, he didn't have the intent to begin with, but nevertheless, the very action itself makes it already valid. Okay, so he's fulfilled it. Okay. Omar Rava, so along comes Rava, or according to another, according to the marginal note on the right over there, it was Rava, because maybe it's not Rava's opinion, but it's somebody else's. It's Rava. You have Rava, you have Rava. They're two different people, okay? So, we'll accept the marginal note. So, Rabbi said as follows, Zosimeris, in other words, he says, Hatokeya l'shir yotza. If a person takes a shofar in order to play a melody upon it, yeah, so he's yotza. Even though what? He did not have the kavanah at the time that he was playing the melody, that, you know, he wanted to fulfill the mitzvah of, because as we say, according to this opinion, that we say that if the guy, you know, ate matzah, even though he didn't have the kavanah, but nevertheless it was yotzei, or as we pointed out in some other cases that we had, as for example, the, you know, the blowing of the shofar, which came from an animal dedicated to Avodah Zarah, right? Where we said he should to begin with, but if he did, he's yotze. So in other words, under certain circumstances, you're yotze, even if you don't have the kavanah to begin with.
Yes,
yeah, look.
So
yeah.
Forcing him to blow the shofar, play a tune on the shofar.
Yeah, he was not talking about forcing. He's doing it for his own entertainment, right? He decides he likes the sounds of the sofa, so he's practicing making sounds with it. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Didn't we learn that you can't have a Noah, and you know, you're not supposed to. If
yeah, right. This okay. So the answer is, but still, you know, okay. We always have this problem. Okay, we know that when we daven, we should have kavanah, right? We should have kavanah. We have the intention that we want to fulfill the obligation of davening. Okay. Now, let's say your mind wanders. Okay. During the course of the davening. Yeah. Doesn't happen, of course. Yeah. Or it happens too frequently. I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, how do you keep that?
Okay. So, does it therefore negate the fact that you davened or not? The answer is no. Yeah. So, there's a case, you see, where even though you don't have the kavanah, but nevertheless, you're yotzei. Okay. Jerry?
Well, what if, you know, if I see you sleeping all the time,
yeah,
and I say, I've got to blow the shofar, but at the same time, I can wake you up.
Yeah.
So, my intent is double.
Yeah, okay. That's a very good question.
The body of purpose of the shofar,
right.
I mean, and you know, and when a person has this kind of inclination or this kind of desire,
yeah,
you can't often, you know, cut it in two.
Right.
One is more important than the other. The mitzvah blowing the shofar is more important than the intent of saying, I'm going to wake that guy up. Yeah,
right,
you
know, okay. All right. So if I wake up, oi, shofar, whoa, I'm yotzei.
If your mind wanders,
yeah,
you're davening with kavanah,
yeah,
and thoughts begin to wander.
Right.
That really doesn't take away the kavanah, does it?
To a certain extent, it does. Essentially, you still have the kavanah that you want to daven. But you're not concentrating upon what you're saying to the extent that you should. Right. But nevertheless, as I say, it doesn't negate the fact that you're fulfilling the mitzvah. Right. Yes. Oh, okay, Arthur. Right. Say hello to Marcia. Okay? Yeah. All right. Yeah. So, all right, so the third line from the bottom, he said, so Rabba says, okay, in other words, if the guy blows shofar simply because he likes the sounds of it, nevertheless, he's yotzei, right? So the Gemara says, Pshita, yeah, shouldn't this be obvious? Hainu hach, isn't that the same as some of the other cases we've already discussed above in this page? So he says, no, maybe not, maybe it's not the same thing. Mahu de teimor, maybe you would say, awesome. In the previous case, when we were talking about where the guy was compelled to eat matzah, right? And we said that he has fulfilled the obligation of eating matzah. But why? Because the Torah has laid down a law that says on the first night of Pesach you must eat matzah, so that you are fulfilling a mitzvah that the Torah itself has ordained that we have to, right? Yeah, another moment, right. So, Omer Achmon, right. And he did eat it. Torah says, eat matzah, so he ate it. So therefore what? So therefore he has fulfilled it. All right, now we're ready for the next page, wherever it may be. Jerry, are you with the distribution business? Why don't I do it the other page?
Here,
sorry. Okay, right, okay. You need fast circulation around here.
One for
I count out enough for a whole world.
Okay. All right. So now we're on the second side, Chavches Omid Beis, right? And the Gemara continues. It says, "Aval Hacha." But in this case, namely about blowing a shofar, and we're talking about the guy who's playing it because he likes the sounds that he makes on it, Zichron Truoxith, Torah says, remember the memorial of the blowing of the shofar. In other words, you have to bear in mind that you are blowing the shofar. And therefore, we would say, if he was just blowing music and not doing it because he wanted to fulfill the mitzvah of blowing shofar, then in that particular case, right, we say that he should not be yotzei, right? The high misasek be'almahu. And in this case, he's only a misasek. The misasek means that he's only practicing something or other, okay? Literally, he's busying himself with whatever it may be. So he's practicing. That's all he's doing. So kamash malon, right? Nevertheless, we learn even that in this case, what? That as long as he blew the shofar, even if he did not really have the primary intention of doing it, that what? That he would be Yotze.
Even if he
this
didn't.
Is what Robert's saying. Yeah. Right.
He was playing a tune and he would be
yeah,
still
yeah, yeah, right. This is what he says. That doesn't mean that this is necessarily the accepted halacha. It is not the accepted halacha. The accepted halacha is that you have to have kavana. And as we'll see, as we go on, this as we continue with this page, the kavana applies to two. It applies to the shomea, the person who's listening, that you have to have the kavana, but it also applies to the mashmia, to the person who's blowing the shofar, because he wants you to hear the sound of the shofar. Okay? And this is why well, Rabbi Sonnenschein, other rabbis, before we come to the blowing of the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, we say, have in mind, that you want to be you want to fulfill the mitzvah of the blowing the shofar, just as so-and-so was blowing the shofar. It used to be back in the old days when I used to blow shofar. Now Rabbi Saidi, I hope, or somebody else would be blowing shofar. That he has in mind, too, that he wants to be motzi. In other words, cause everybody, enable everybody to fulfill the mitzvah. So that is really what becomes the psak. Okay. But right now, for the sake of argument, we're saying that even if just tootles away on his shofar, nevertheless, if he had in mind that he's blowing shofar, then in that case he is yaitzeh with him.
Is that Zaidi's shofar this morning? Was that his personal
shofar? I think so. Yeah. Yeah, he did a good job this morning.
Yeah.
Right. Absolutely.
Nice.
Right. Yeah. Alma, so we see from this that Kasova Rava, that Rava is of the opinion of mitzvos ain sirichos kavana, right? That mitzvos do not require kavana. You can fulfill a mitzvah even if you don't have the kavana to begin with. Okay. So, Eisvei.
That can't be right.
Huh? It can't be right. It is right in the sense that I said before, that you should have kavana when you fulfill a mitzvah. Nevertheless, if you do it, even without the kavana, nevertheless, you have fulfilled it.
He's blowing a tune.
Okay, so in other words, we would say in that particular case, that's an exception. Why? Because the Torah says, zichron trua, that you have to bear in mind, in your memory, in other words, in your mind, that you are blowing it in order to fulfill, and not just.
So,
right. So, you have differences of opinion. This is not accepted. I mean, this may be Rava's opinion, but it's not accepted, okay, in this particular case. But as I say, that's because we don't accept the principle. We accept the idea that you have to have kavana when it comes to blowing the shofar. It's a mitzvah that requires it. Eisvei. So they ask the following question. It says, Hoya Kore.